Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome back to Ruination, the early years. We're continuing our deep dive into the source material, looking at those really crucial, defining moments from the early days of Big Fatty Online.
And this time we are tackling the final week of February 2008. That's episodes 17 through 21, running February 25th right up to the 29th, Leap Day.
Right. A really packed week. It feels like the end of the beginning, almost. The show's been running for maybe a month and a half.
Exactly. And you see everything converging. He finally lands in the iTunes store, which is a huge deal. There's this frantic pre-cruise energy. And, of course, plenty of podcaster drama.
Yeah, let's remind everyone about the context. Big Fatty's recording daily, Monday to Friday, from the coal mine, as he calls it.
Right, the coal mine. And that name is so important, isn't it? It's not just, you know, where he works. It's symbolic.
How so?
Well, it represents that sort of a oppressive day job reality he's stuck in. And it contrasts so sharply with the wild personal stuff he's putting out on the show.
The structure is fixed, though, usually exactly 20 minutes.
Precisely 20 minutes. But the content, completely unpredictable, yep. Totally personal. And this week really nails his whole philosophy. It's not just ruined. It's me, Big Fatty Online.
Okay, so let's get into it. Nothing says unstable and online like the podcaster politics of early 2008. It seems like the moment BFO got that iTunes success, the internal drama just kind of blew up.
Oh, absolutely. We have to start with the four-star controversy. That was really heating up right at the start of the week, Monday the 25th.
Right. This involved Anthony from Ashanti No Lemon.
Yeah. It's fascinating, really. It's like the loyalty police were out in force. Anthony had dared, and I mean dared to, leave a four-star review for another big show in their circle, the Q-Cast.
Only four stars. Not five.
Not five. And for that, Big Fatty gleefully reported he was getting vertical spankings from, well, seemingly everyone.
And that RNL network, Real Network Live, that was like a serious betrayal, wasn't it?
Totally. Getting reviews was hard work. Subscriptions were everything. So anything less than five stars felt like an attack, almost. It showed how competitive, maybe even aggressive, that little world was.
And Big Fatty, just watching from the sideline.
Oh, yeah. Stirring the pot a bit. He made sure his listeners knew where to go to hear the fallout. Q-Cats connection or Archer's show for the, you know, the full story and the rebuttals.
It's like drama as cross promotion.
Pretty much, yeah. But then, just as Anthony's taking all this heat, suddenly a diversion, a major one.
Yes. Enter the podcaster known only as Snowflake.
That's him. The unnamed but constantly discussed certain podcaster. He became the new target. Basically saving Anthony overnight.
And the reason he got stuck with that nickname Snowflake is just, it's legendary BFO pettiness, isn't it?
It really is. He'd cancel a trip, a big promoted trip to New York City.
Okay. Why?
Well, the alleged reason. He was, and I quote, afraid of the many relatives of his that were falling out of the sky.
Meaning
snow. Plain old winter weather. He canceled because it might snow. And bam, he's Snowflake forever in the archives. Fragile. Can't handle a bit of weather.
And just hammering that name Snowflake over and over.
It served a purpose, right?
Two purposes, yeah. First, it's just funny, easy content for Fatty's listeners. Clickbait before clickbait, almost. Second, it completely takes the focus off Anthony and the four-star thing. Drama neutralized.
Fatty even pointed that out, didn't he?
He did. He actually suggested Anthony should send Snowflake a thank you note, you know, for drawing all the fire, getting Anthony out of the spotlight.
It's kind of an early masterclass in managing online drama, using the network's own conflicts for content.
Definitely. It showed BFO was gaining influence, becoming a place that could sort of shape the conversation, even if it was just about someone being scared of a flight.
So while all that infighting is happening, Big Fatty starts getting this external validation that really changes things. Let's talk about the iTunes status report. This is also Monday, February 25th. Yeah, this is the week he finally stopped giving the finger to iTunes, as he put it. The show landed, and boom, instant success. It shows what happens when a dedicated niche audience finally gets easy access.
He gets listed under new and notable.
Right, in two big categories, society and culture and personal journals. And he loved pointing out he was right next to, we're mean because you're fat.
Which kind of placed him immediately, didn't it? Irreverent, personal, maybe a bit crude.
Exactly. Part of that landscape. And more than that, he shot up the charts. He said, number 7 under the top podcast of the day.
And this was after only being listed for, what, 3 days?
Just 3 days. For a brand new show with no real marketing push, that tells you the audience is already there, just waiting.
But here's the interesting part, I think. He mentioned the reviews were still pretty low, like 10, then maybe 18.
Right.
But what really got him excited was a listener report. Kellen from Arlington, Texas.
Yeah, Kellen reported that the BFO popularity bars in iTunes were already full.
So why'd that matter more? The algorithm's approval over human reviews.
Well, think about it. Reviews are subjective, right? They could be part of these feuds, like the 4-star thing.
Mm.
But the full popularity bar, that was data. Quantifiable proof of downloads, of consumption.
Ah, okay. So it showed immediate, undeniable reach, faster than waiting for reviews to trickle in.
Exactly. Algorithmic success, which even back in 2008 was starting to be the real measure of relevance on these platforms.
And we got a sense of who was driving that success from the listeners also subscribe to list.
Yeah, that was like a perfect snapshot. The 773 podcast, the Trunk Cast, the Gay 22, Defunct, A Gay Nerd's Life.
So firmly in that queer podcasting niche, a specific dedicated audience connecting with this raw personal style.
Definitely. Which was a big part of that whole RNL network, fostering these interconnected, sort of unfiltered shows.
Okay, so huge domestic validation. But it didn't stop there, did it? On the 28th, something else happened.
International breakthrough. Arthur, who hosted Amron's podcast,
He
discovered that Big Fatty Online was ranked number 21 out of 100 personal journal podcasts in the Australian iTunes store.
Wow. Number 21 in Australia. That's pretty unexpected.
Totally unexpected. It showed the appeal wasn't just local or U.S.-centric. Something about this show was connecting globally, even with all the specific American references.
And Fatty's reaction wasn't just, thanks, Australia. It was different.
Oh, yeah. Classic Big Fatty. He issued a demand. He called out the Australian hunka hunka thunder from down unders. His words... to stop lurking.
Stop listening anonymously.
Exactly. Get on the listener map. Identify yourselves. He wanted tangible proof of this audience, not just a ranking. He wanted them to commit to be part of the community officially.
It's that direct challenge again. Listening isn't passive. You got to participate.
Right. It reinforces that whole idea. And this global validation combined with the U.S. charts really cemented BFO as a show that was, you know, rapidly on the rise.
Okay. So external validation, check. But internally, within the podcaster group, there was this other contagion spread.
Yes. iPhone fever.
It really was like a fever, wasn't it? Right. Spreading through the whole community.
Absolutely. The iPhone was still pretty new, only out for a few months. And owning one instantly marked you as, like, cutting edge. Part of the in crowd.
And Fatty meticulously listed everyone who caught the bug.
He did. Like a daily health report. Michael from QCast Connection, Ricky from Foul Monkeys, Sarah Davis, John Michael Hawes, Chef Mark, Eric the Southern Boy.
Ryan from Boston.
Ryder from Boston, yeah. It turned getting a phone into this public performance, a test of whether you were keeping up.
And the Brian from Boston story was kind of the peak of the absurdity, wasn't it? The engagement pictures.
Oh, totally. Fatty described these pictures on the Little Fatty website showing Brian basically marrying his iPhone. The satire was just dripping.
Predicting a big gathering to, what was it, consummate the marriage with pinching technology?
Exactly. Pinching technology, that multi-touch screen. It sounds funny now, but it highlights how revolutionary those features felt in 2008. The phone wasn't just a tool. It was like a character in their ongoing drama.
Representing that pressure to adopt the latest tech.
Right. Which brings us to the resistance,
The
holdouts.
Namely, Big Fatty himself and Archer.
The two main resistors. And Fatty immediately created a narrative around it, dubbing them Snowflake and Fatty, like a 70s detective duo.
The irony being they're united against Apple, while Snowflake is simultaneously getting grief for being afraid of weather.
It's perfect BFO logic.
Yep.
They were the old guard resisting change. Though Fatty did note some people... like Scotty and Arthur in Australia, couldn't even get iPhones yet. Apple wasn't fully operational there.
But Fatty's own resistance was starting to crumble, wasn't it? The cruise was coming up fast.
Yeah, connectivity on the cruise was probably on his mind. So on February 28th, he made a public plea, a wish list request.
Classic move. Turn a personal need into a challenge for the listeners.
Exactly. He's flying out the next day, leap day, the 29th. He wants an iPhone delivered and waiting for him when he gets back and checks his mail at the coal mine on Monday, March 10th.
That's a pretty big ask. Basically asking the audience to buy him an iPhone.
Huge ask.
Yeah.
A real test of their loyalty and, frankly, their willingness to spend money on the show.
And he was very specific about how it had to happen.
Incredibly specific. No mail at the coal mine, so it had to be FedEx to a physical address.
Yeah.
And to get the address, you had to contact Larry H. Vader.
Larry H. Vader, the behind-the-scenes tech and logistics guy, the one dealing with all the messy details of Fatty's public life.
Right. So asking for the phone this way blended the public plea with these, like, private, precise instructions. It forced listeners to engage with the show's actual operational reality, made them feel even more invested.
This whole tech divide, the resistance, it actually sets up one of the week's big highlights perfectly. The Gaze segment.
The recurring interview feature. And on the 27th, he had a major guest. Real podcasting royalty.
Archer from Archer Radio.
The godfather of podcasting, as Fatty called him. And deservedly so, Archer had something like 629 episodes already. That's staggering for 2008.
And the setup was intimate, right? They were video chatting.
Yeah, which led to some giggling and laughing, Fatty noted. It made them both seem more human. He even mentioned Archer was wearing plaid, setting that visual.
The interview itself was full of these great little biographical details.
Goldmine. We learn Archer smokes Marlboro Lights. And the detail that his mom buys them for him at the commissary for $30 a carton.
Oh.
That grounds the whole Godfather thing in this really specific, kind of frugal reality. We also found out his goatee wasn't new. He'd had it since Bush took office in 2000.
Little details that stick with you.
Totally. Then they got into travel. And here's the contradiction. Massive online presence. Very limited physical travel.
He hates crowds, apparently.
Hates crowds. Never been west of Missouri, south of South Carolina, or north of Massachusetts. Really restricted.
But he had a dream destination.
New Zealand. Why? Small population, liberal policies, the opposite of what he avoided, and pragmatically. He mentioned maybe staying with Arthur, the guy from Australia who found the iTunes ranking. So even the dream trip involves some careful cost-saving planning.
Okay, but the absolute highlight of the interview had to be the good gosh and gay moment.
Oh, definitely. It started with Archer noticing young guys, twinks, working at Banana Republic while he was shopping with his boyfriend.
And that led to the confession.
The big one. Archer admits he wears lesbian shoes.
Lesbian shoes.
His words, plain, simple, flat-heeled. And he confirms it by saying, yes, I own Birkenstocks.
That is amazing. Why is that so defining, do you think?
Because it just shatters expectations, right?
Yeah.
Archer, the godfather, the guy maybe perceived as meticulous or anal, he's totally comfortable admitting this, well, deeply unmacho fashion choice. It's vulnerability wrapped in humor.
And speaking of anal, he actually addressed that perception directly.
He did. He admitted he is not anal about cleaning his car. Why? He lives in a high rise, hates paying for a car wash, simple logistics trumping any desire for perfection.
Again, it makes him really relatable, doesn't it?
Completely. Grounds him. And the interview ended in the only way it could, really.
Well, it's giving the finger.
Both giving the finger to each other and to the listeners. Perfect, irreverent sign-off. Captured their friendship and the show's whole vibe.
It really shows Fatty's growing clout, doesn't it? Getting these intimate interviews with respected figures like Archer right alongside talking about, well, other stuff.
Like Bud Zitz and Snowfear, yeah. It shows the unique pull the show was developing.
And that intimacy was balanced by the listener feedback, which was often just as unfiltered and really shaped the show's humor. Let's talk about the frequency debate from February 26th.
Right. Fatty was wondering, maybe feeling the strain, and asked, is 5 shows a week too much?
And the listeners responded. Matt from Spanky B. Arthur had the definitive answer.
Yeah, the consensus was basically, keep doing it as long as it's fun for you.
Yeah.
But Matt gave us the analogy of the week, maybe the analogy of the show's history up to that point.
The daily dose of fiber.
The daily dose of fiber. He said the reliable 20-minute show helped listeners with their colonic discharges while on the john.
Oh my God.
It instantly locked the show's structure into this crude, but somehow essential daily ritual. It wasn't just entertainment. It was like functional, bodily functional.
That is peak BFO, taking the format and tying it directly to a bowel movement.
And it stuck. That analogy became part of the language of the show. It shows how even the grossest humor could build loyalty by making the show feel indispensable to your daily routine.
Okay, then there was the other memorable listener interaction that week, the pre-recorded interview with Wes from Live It Up. This was on the 28th.
Wes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a newer podcaster, apparently inspired by the Little Fatty Cast, the older, more network-focused show.
And he was completely unprepared for Big Fatty's performance during their interview.
Totally unprepared. Fatty went full crassness, as Wes put it. It seemed like a deliberate strategy, almost, to test the limits of newer listeners. Fatty even claimed he didn't remember the interview.
Right. And when Wes asked how podcasting improved his life, Fatty's response was, memorable.
Memorable is one word for it. I used to have a tiny tack and it was embarrassing. Now I'm huge and loving it. Yeah. Just out of nowhere.
And he kept going, right? Being weird.
Totally weird. Wes asked if he was okay. And Fatty just said regenerating, which led Wes to genuinely ask if he was a cyborg or a robot. The whole thing felt designed to push people away.
But it didn't, did it? The reaction was surprising.
Exactly. No real backlash. In fact, Wes himself called back in on the 29th, Leap Day, to wish Fatty bon voyage for the cruise.
Uh-huh.
And he asked the question that showed he totally got it, that he'd bought into the whole BFO brand of humor. Would you let everyone know if fat really does float?
Wow. So asking about Fatty's actual body, turning his weight into this shared joke for the cruise.
It's the ultimate buy-in, right? It shows the listener accepted the premise, accepted the host, warts and all, or maybe because of the warts. Fatty's physical reality became public domain, part of the show's fabric.
Speaking of reality checks and audience engagement, that last episode before the cruise, February 29th, had a couple more gems.
Yeah, it was packed with these little corrections and ailments.
First, the geography lesson. Bill, the gay construction worker, called in.
Right, Bill, who also claimed credit for submitting BFO to iTunes.
He called to correct Fatty about the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yep. They're a Missouri team, not Kansas, because the stadium is on the Missouri side of the border.
The level of detail the audience is paying attention to, fact-checking state lines and team locations.
It shows deep engagement, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They care about getting the details right.
And then the final moment of pre-trip vulnerability. The ultimate TMI, perhaps.
The butt zit.
Yeah.
Fatty shared, quite openly, that at 51 years old, he developed a painful zit right on his butt just before leaving.
And he didn't just mention it, he elaborated.
Oh, yeah. He offered his expert opinion. Zits on the ear or the butt are the most painful.
You have to ask, does sharing something that personal, that unpleasant, risk turning listeners off?
Not in the BFO universe.
Right.
For this brand, that kind of raw vulnerability equals authenticity. It's a calculated risk, maybe, but it pays off in intimacy. Sharing the precise location of his pre-cruise pain just confirmed. Nothing is off limits here.
Right before he leaves the coal mine for a week.
It's that structure paradox again, isn't it? The stable daily format allows him to share the most unstable, unfiltered, physical, personal details imaginable.
Okay, so butt zit status confirmed, Chiefs geography corrected. It's finally time to sign off for the cruise. Leap Day.
Yep, the countdown is over. Logistics are locked. Fly out Friday the 29th, two nights in Fort Lauderdale. Board the ship March 2nd, return March 9th.
And crucially, he promised content wouldn't stop.
Right. He committed to putting out shows next week, aiming for 4 episodes The Gays, a music-only Memory Lane episode, maybe even some cruise updates if possible. The routine had to continue, even remotely.
And his music choice for that Friday's Memory Lane music segment felt very fitting.
The Flying Nun theme. From the old TV show 1967 to 1970 about Sister Bertrell, who could, well, fly.
And he said it kind of encapsulates what he was doing that day.
Yeah, it suggests this feeling of maybe being lifted off, maybe slightly out of control, flying into this adventure powered by something external, maybe the audience, maybe just the momentum of the show.
And then the final words for the week, a weird website recommendation.
Stuffwhitepeoplelike.com, yeah.
Random.
And that final, bizarre, instantly iconic sign off.
Lord, I've left my camisole.
Perfect. What does it even mean? Who knows? But it felt like the right kind of chaotic end note.
Absolutely. A perfect end to a week where BFO really hammered home its identity, leaning into conflict with Snowflake, soaking up validation from iTunes, embracing radical intimacy with Archer Shoes and the butt sit.
It feels like this week, Feb 25th to 29th, 2008, really crystallized how BFO worked. Conflict, validation, intimacy, all held together by that rigid 20-minute daily structure.
That structure is the key, isn't it? That consistency allows all the volatile stuff to land, to be processed by the audience day after day, which brings us back to Matt's brilliant crude analogy.
The daily dose of fiber, leading to colonic discharges. Exactly. And it makes you, the listener, think as you go through these archives. Was the show hitting big just because the content was so wild and compelling? Or was its real power the fact that it gave listeners this incredibly reliable, predictable daily routine, like fiber?
Is consistency sometimes more valuable than novelty, especially when building that kind of intense loyalty? Think about the reliable rituals you consume daily. Why does that predictability matter even when the content itself is maybe crude or challenging?
Did that unwavering commitment to showing up day after day for just 20 minutes make the host indispensable in a way that flashier, less consistent shows can never be?
The structure enables the ritual enables the intimacy, and that complex relationship is really at the heart of Ruination, the early years.
We'll leave you with that thought.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll be back next time to unpack what happens when Fatty actually gets on that cruise ship.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend.